While China is literally on the other side of the world from us here in Illinois, the connections between Illinois and China continue to grow. Welcome to the second hour of China, Beyond the Great Wall. I'm Sam Unger, one of 10 journalism students who recently traveled to China as part of Professor Nancy Benson's international reporting class.
And I'm Lauren Thorbjornsson. As foreign correspondents in training, we each researched and reported stories in China. As we told you in the first hour, all eyes will soon be focused on China as the setting for the 2008 Olympics. But many Illinois companies have been focused on China since the late 1970s, when it opened its doors to outsiders. They've been doing business in China for decades.
In this hour, we'll examine the growing economic interdependence between China and Illinois, and explain why so many central Illinois soybean farmers increasingly rely on Chinese farmers to earn their living.
We'll also report on how the relatively recent focus on business profit and economic growth in China is creating new opportunities for Chinese workers.
And that's having a big impact on the role of women and family traditions.
But we begin this hour with a look at three Illinois companies doing business in China. John Paul reports.
The men and women making circuit protection equipment at this factory in Suzhou, China, just outside of Shanghai, are not unlike those who work in the States. The fuses and arresters they assemble in this plant, operated by Des Plaines, Illinois-based Little Fuse, will wind up in cell phones, in cars, digital cameras, DVD players, and millions of other consumer electronics around the world. 1,200 people work here at Little Fuse's biggest Chinese factory. Sam Jiang is one of them. She is a 35-year-old woman who has worked as a data processor at Little Fuse 7 years. Jiang is one of many women who work in this American factory because managers say women seem to be better handling the small fuses. After working for two Chinese-owned companies, she says she likes this job best.
Whereas when I came here, I find everyone was very passionate. And everyone was learning or anxious for learning more things, learning more knowledge, learning more, developing their own skills. And so that's something I liked quite a lot of the American company, because when embedded in this fast-paced company, I myself was encouraged to develop my own self, to challenge myself.
Little Fuse came to Suzhou 10 years ago and now has three plants in China, with a fourth under construction in nearby Wuxi. Little Fuse considers itself the worldwide leader in circuit protection devices. Little Fuse is cutting back domestic operations. In March, the company began to phase out manufacturing at its headquarters in suburban Chicago and move 300 jobs there to Mexico, the Philippines, and China. CEO Gordon Hunter says it's just smart business because his company's biggest customers, like cell phone maker Motorola, are in China too.
Being close to customers and being close to our suppliers makes sense, and we've more and more developed suppliers that are in China because there's been a huge growth in companies that would supply the materials that go into our products. And then, of course, there's an abundant capability of labor at very global competitive rates in China. And so all of that fits together for this making a strong business case.
Little Fuse is not alone in coming to China. Today, more than 300 Illinois companies are on the ground in mainland China, making, selling, and servicing this nation of 1.3 billion people. It's the fastest-growing economy in the world, and affluent Chinese consumers are hungry for Western products. Statistics from the Chinese government show China's growth, measured by its gross domestic product, booming along at nearly 11% in 2006. Global growth is at just 3.5%. The state of Illinois set up trade offices in China 7 years ago to help Illinois companies make connections and grab a piece of this growing market economy. Illinois is now one of 27 states with a trade office in China, and the state now ranks fifth in total exports to China. Last year, Illinois sent $1.5 billion worth of goods to mainland China, more than double what it had sent 5 years before. The state's top exports to China are machinery, waste and scrap, electrical equipment and appliances, chemicals, and agricultural goods. From his Shanghai office, Illinois trade expert Zachary Zhao says Illinois companies should not let communism in China scare off business.
We benefit from the continuously improved relationship between Beijing and Washington, and between the trade relationship between Chicago and Shanghai. That enhanced the ties, give us the chance, you know, really to promote trade and investment. And then that paves the way for Illinois companies to come here smoothly and quickly. And that's one thing politically, it's more opening.
The Center for China in the World Economy at Beijing's Tsinghua University predicts China's economy will continue to grow for another 3 or 4 decades, surpassing the U.S. by 2025. Professor Taming Huo is at Peking University's China Center for Economic Research. He agrees that China's economy still has much growth in coming years. Only a change in government leadership could slow it down.
I would say political instability, okay, that's obviously always a factor need to be considered given the political system here, still a one-party dictator, and that is on everybody's mind that the democracy, when it will come.
Peoria-based Caterpillar is banking on China's future. Last fall, CAT moved its Asian headquarters from Tokyo to Beijing. CAT was one of the first American companies to do business in China. Caterpillar first came here in the 1970s. Today, CAT has 15 facilities throughout mainland China and just over 5,000 employees. CAT's CEO, Jim Owens, says the earth-moving equipment maker has sales in China estimated at $1 billion a year and growing. Building roads and dams, clearing land for development, mining and shipping has increased Chinese demand for CAT's diesel engines and tractors. With the company's domestic sales steady, it has looked to Asia and other parts of the world for profit. Jim Dugan is CAT's spokesman in Beijing. He says despite a growing presence in China, CAT still exports plenty of American-made products to China.
By itself, China represents an enormous opportunity, if you will, from a sales standpoint, and that's an important part of that strategy going forward. It's also important as a manufacturing base as well, as part of our global manufacturing strategy.
The labor union that represents more than 6,000 Caterpillar workers in the Peoria area does not seem overly concerned about the company's expansion into China. UAW Local 974 Vice President Rick Doty says union membership in the Peoria area has grown significantly in the last 2 or 3 years. Doty says there is plenty of work to be done in Peoria.
They've got a strong base here in America. They've got a very skilled workforce here in America, and they'll continue to use that workforce because it does supplement their business in other regions of the world. What we build here doesn't just stay here. You know, they do continue to ship product all over the world right out of Peoria.
You don't have to be a Fortune 500 company to have a China strategy. Simtech is in the small Piatt County town of Bement. Simtech makes spin-on fuel filters, the kind on most gas station pumps, the last filter before the fuel hits your tank. About 100 people work at Simtech, and while this family-owned company already sells its product globally with $15 to $25 million in annual sales, it is not firmly in China yet. Because of the growing economy, more and more Chinese are buying and driving cars. And company president James Ayers says inferior Chinese fuel filters mean dirty fuel and dirty air. To him, Simtech and China are a winning combination.
Certainly, many corporations are now doing business in China as part of their routine activity, and we just see it as an opportunity for us to continue to be a competitive company by being there as well as here.
In fact, Ayers is guessing sales for his company could increase by 50% in 5 to 7 years if Simtek manufactures and sells filters in mainland China. Exporting everything from Bement could mean a 35% tariff, and that would not make Simtek products affordable in the Chinese market. But Ayers is convinced his China strategy can be a great first step.
It means maybe more diversity in locations and hopefully just more production equipment. Maybe not more employees in the U.S., but it does provide us with some opportunities. And then you figure that the China market also gives us access into India, which would be the second most populous country, and they likewise are increasing their economy. And then also Chinese are very active in Africa.
The experts say it's never too late for an Illinois company to have a China strategy. But there are things a company should do before jumping to Shanghai or Beijing tomorrow. Experts say first, do your homework. Know what your potential and markets might be in China. While China is hungry for cars and copper, chemicals and machinery, other goods may not be as much in demand. And consider starting with a joint venture instead of going it alone. Second, understand the governmental business process in China. Know about tariffs and taxes. Know about licensing. The U.S. Commerce Department and the Illinois Trade Office offer ways to help small companies get started. Third, beware of the potential for the Chinese to steal your idea. Protecting your intellectual property, your patent and trademark are vital in China. Business lawyers operating in Shanghai say China's government is getting better at IP protection and prosecution, but it's still up to the business to be aware. Fourth, plan to have one of your firm's best employees on the ground in China every day. Business consultant Bill Barron says don't even try to run a Chinese operation from the States.
You can't just sell there. You have to, if you're going to sell there, you have to manufacture the product there to be price competitive. Because there's going to be, no matter what business you're in, there's going to be local Chinese competitor making a similar product. So if you're not manufacturing there and taking advantage of that low cost base, you're just going to be so much more, importing is going to be so much more expensive. And then on top of it, there are still tariffs, as we said before.
Back at the little fuse factory in Suzhou, China, it's another day of making fuses. Suzhou presents thousands of opportunities for skilled workers. More than 10,000 companies operate factories or plants in Suzhou alone. A new job could be right across the street. David Zhang is one such worker. He's a 37-year-old project engineer who's had two other jobs with Chinese companies before landing at Littelfuse a year ago. He knows he could find other work in Suzhou, probably at more money, but he says he's content to live a standard Chinese life.
I learn a lot from solving different new technical issues. After solving each technical issue, I feel it's an opportunity to show my own ability. That makes me feel happy.
Corporate experts say there is much happiness and profit and growth to be gained by doing business in China. The U.S. Commerce Department says the opportunity is there for Illinois companies with a smart China strategy. In Beijing, I'm John Paul.
China's economy isn't the only thing that's growing because of new business ties. Higher salaries from a booming economy mean more Chinese are eating pork, chicken, and fish, and that's largely possible because of soybeans from Illinois and other states.
Farmers in the world's most populous country simply cannot meet the increasing demand for soybeans, so each year more and more of them, worth billions of dollars, cross the Pacific Ocean. Michael Kaliska looks at how soybeans are the fuel that keeps the Chinese engine running.
It is too tough to be a farmer, says Cao Luchen. The 44-year-old is planting soybeans. With a small metal spatula, she digs 2-inch deep holes into the soil and puts 3 soybeans into each hole. Cao Luchen is one of China's about 750 million farmers, many of whom are working the fields the way they did 100 years ago. It takes several hours for Cao Luchen to plant her half-acre soybean field.
Now we have a machine to harvest, but before we did everything by hand.
Cao Luchen also grows cotton and rice, as do many other farmers in Wujia, a village in Jiangsu province about 3 hours by car from Shanghai. The big houses next to the farm fields are an indication that Wujia is relatively prosperous, but not from farming.
Oh, no. If my husband wouldn't work in the city, we wouldn't be able to afford a house.
Her husband works as a decorator in a town near Beijing and sends money to his wife as often as he can. Cao Luchen sees him only once a year, at the Chinese New Year.
We get used to that. That happens every year.
On average, a Chinese farmer has about an acre of land, or the size of roughly half a football field. Cao Luchen says she'd rather work in a factory where she can make up to $8 a day, but there aren't any factories nearby. Instead, she works for a local soybean and grain trader who pays her about $3 a day. She often helps to separate soybeans into different sizes. While 2 women filter the beans with the machine, 6 others sit in front of a big pile of beans and separate the good soybeans from the bad by hand. The bad soybeans are fed to about 100 pigs, which soybean trader Li Sipin keeps next door to his little workshop.
This feed reduces the cost of raising pigs, and it is very nutritional, and the pigs grow very big.
Li Sipin employs about 20 people. He says the foundation for his company were laid when Deng Xiaoping started encouraging entrepreneurship in China in the early 1980s. Li says he even received a prize from the county government in Nantong for being the first in the area to start a business.
There is an old Chinese saying, whoever dares to bite first into a crab. You see, I was in the local government, but then I changed to a businessman. In that respect, I am a kind of pioneer in our district.
As a member of the Communist Party, Li rose to power in his community about 25 years ago.
My house was built as one of the earliest in our area. I earned a lot of money back then, and at that time, everyone else lived in a very simple house with clay walls. Around here, I was the first to have a new house and a telephone.
But Li says since he started trading soybeans and rice about 8 years ago, his social status has improved and he makes more money than he did before.
What? I am planning to buy apartments in the city for my grandchildren. I want them to live in the city. I will buy a flat in Nantong and in Shanghai.
Yet, the decisions in the family business are not Li's alone. He is in partnership with his son and his wife.
Theoretically, I am in charge, but we are one big family. And in fact, everyone runs his part of the business by himself.
Li's wife Chang Hong sells all the soybeans her husband buys from the farmers in Nantong at the market in Shanghai. She and her husband also trade soybeans from the 3 northeastern provinces where most of China's soybeans are grown.
The mid-sized soybeans are from the northeastern provinces, and those are mostly used for soy milk. Here, the bigger ones are from Nantong, and people from Shanghai like them a lot. They cook them with pork ribs. The tofu we like is usually made from the smaller Nantong beans.
In their 2 stores, Chang Hong and her family sell up to 15 tons of soybeans, rice, and peanuts a day. They work up to 16 hours or more a day if necessary. Chang Hong's daughter-in-law, Wang Chungyan, runs the second shop. She says it is not important how many hours one works.
What we are mostly concerned about is how much profit we can make. So it doesn't matter how many hours I have to work and have a few hours for resting. As long as we can make money, we will work a lot.
The about 10 million tons of soybeans that China imported from the United States last year didn't affect business for Chung Hong and Li Zipin. Li says there's no real competition because American soybeans are imported for oil and animal feed, and Chinese soybeans are for human consumption.
The taste of this is not comparable to the soybean from the U.S. China's beans are much better, I think.
In my eye, there's no competition because Chinese soybeans have some serious quality problems, which means that Chinese soybeans have 2 to 2.5 percentage points less oil. That's a hell of a difference to the crusher. And Chinese beans are not as clean. If you buy a whole train load of Chinese soybeans, you're going to get 10 carloads of gravel. That's what I've been told by, you know, Chinese buyers.
Phil Laney, the head of the American Soybean Association in Beijing, has been in China for the last 12 years advocating the U.S. soybean. Laney says it's because the American soybeans are not used as human food that they have an advantage.
The major growth is in the animal feeding area because of demographics and rising prosperity. And that's what's pulling in the demand for the soybeans. So I see a very, you know, rosy future.
China is already the world's biggest producer of pork, and most chicken eggs are produced and eaten in China. Director of the aquaculture program of the American Soybean Association, Sam Shi, says China also leads the industry for freshwater fish.
The other day we were just talking about, you know, when we were young, and as long as we had an alive fish, the entire family was like having holidays. But nowadays, alive fish is everywhere. People not only want a fish, they want a good quality fish, they want a safe fish, they want organic fish.
He says the Chinese are eating more freshwater fish thanks to imported soybeans. In 1991, the American Soybean Association started an aquaculture program advocating soybeans as fish feed. Before that, Chinese farmers used manure to feed their fish.
They put the manure into the ponds, let the manure, you know, fermentate to produce insect and also to boost the production of the plankton. And then they will want the fish to eat these stuff to grow.
Shi says the soybean-based feed is much more environmental friendly. No water pollution and no fish diseases if the technique is properly applied. And demand for soybeans as fish feed is growing by about 5% a year. This is good news for Chuck Hartke, the director of the Illinois Department of Agriculture. He was particularly happy when the visiting Chinese delegation to Illinois signed a contract to buy more than $2 billion worth of soybeans at the Chicago Board of Trade.
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. And this is really good news because, as you know, Illinois is number one in soybean production consistently. And so we look at that and we say this has got to be good news for Illinois agriculture.
Si Jianye was part of the delegation from China. He says many Chinese prefer to buy soybeans from the U.S. instead from Brazil or Argentina.
Maybe because of the overall management, the U.S. farmers, the growers, they're more reliable and with good reputation. Yeah. And a lot of Brazilian and Argentina's companies, they don't speak English. It's an advantage for U.S. A lot of Chinese companies, the staff, they can speak English, but they cannot speak Spanish or Portuguese.
Sir says, in addition, the transportation costs are much more cheaper in the U.S. The dean of the University of Illinois College of Agriculture, Robert Easter, has been researching the difference in soybean quality by gathering soybeans from around the world.
American soybeans are very consistent in the product. They're not contaminated. And there are demonstrably some advantages in nutrition. And it relates to basic fundamental climate issues. Brazil is a different climate from the U.S.
Since 1987, Easter has been helping Chinese farmers improve their swine feed by adding more soybeans to make the pork more lean.
Traditional Chinese dishes tended to favor fatty pork, and we've learned in this country that eating large amounts of fat is not necessarily a healthy thing to do. So one of the challenges is to convince producers that consumers will actually want lean meat. But that's happening. The market's understanding that. So they do like our product, and of course, hopefully some of the technical support helps to encourage them to see us as a good supplier.
For Easter, this exchange of knowledge between China and the U.S. is exciting, especially since soybeans originated in China and were brought to America in the 19th century.
I think that reflects the wonderful character of this globalized world, because what happens in one part of the world may have some application there, but can tremendously improve the quality of life for people in another part of the world.
But while some farmers are producing more and earning more, most of China's farmers can still only dream of that. Former head of agriculture at the World Bank, Robert Thompson, now teaches at the University of Illinois. He says half the population in China is still living on less than $2 a day, and about 150 million Chinese have to make a living on just about a dollar a day.
At $1 per day, there are even hunger problems. By $2 a day, most of the hunger problems have been taken care of, but you can't afford to eat much meat or fruits or vegetables. In that income range from $2 to about $10 per day, this is where all the growth occurs in consumption of meat and fruits and vegetables, edible oils.
Thompson says he believes the Chinese government might start developing new policies for agriculture production to try and lessen the widening and increasingly problematic income gap between urban and rural areas.
The government has told their farmers in the last couple of years, you can quit growing these lower value crops like corn or soybeans and shift your land into fruits and vegetable production, into fish ponds to maximize their income earning potential.
This policy makes Thompson believe that China will try to import as many soybeans as possible so farmers can raise their income by growing fruits and vegetables. That might sound like a good way to make farming profitable again, but many Chinese policymakers say China is too big and the farmers' land is too small to make this strategy work. Even though China has moved light years ahead, crop yields are still just 60 to 70% of the US, and Fellaini says that handicap should normally be easy to overcome.
But nobody's helping the farmer. And of course, the Chinese farmer has a very low education level. I don't want to put them down. You know, they're hardworking people and they have smart, but you don't have any farmers with master's degrees or PhD degrees. And you don't have anybody using GPS to decide where to put the fertilizer and so forth and so on. So they've got a long way to go.
Mike Cunningham is a soybean farmer from Vermilion County, Illinois. He studied agriculture at Southern Illinois University. Cunningham has about 250 cows. He and his business partner cultivate about 1,600 acres of land. They use a driller to plant soybeans on about 500 acres.
I just got a new tractor which had AutoStir on it, and that has been the greatest thing that I have ever used, and we're actually moving it right now to put it in another tractor so when we drill beans, and I just love the AutoSteer. I just have to sit back and let it drive or steer to the other end.
Back in Wujia, China, farmer Cao Luchen continues planting her soybean seeds.
You don't get as much money for soybeans as you get for cotton. But soybeans are easier to grow. With cotton, you have to use herbicides to get rid of the weed.
It's possible Cao Luchen is the last of several generations of farmers in her family. Her daughter is in school and has a different future in mind.
Oh no, she doesn't want to be a farmer. She wants to be a teacher.
In Wujia, I'm Michael Kuliska.
You're listening to China, Beyond the Great Wall, a radio documentary produced by 10 journalism students from the University of Illinois. We traveled to China as part of Professor Nancy Benson's International Reporting course to follow the path many Illinois companies have blazed to China and to document how China's growing economy is changing the lives of the Chinese people.
1983年小巷是二月晴朗，沿着地基脏打地基继续推向街机。 It's more common these days for women to run the household alone or join their husbands to find work in the city. Economic development combined with some strict population control measures have led to new opportunities for young Chinese women. Elizabeth Murray reports on the so-called one-child policy that has relieved some of the pressure on women to wed and have families of their own.
The policy, restricting Chinese families to one or two children, has been in effect for 26 years, creating two generations of one-child families. But the policy is slowly losing its grip in China. With the birth rate slowing down to 13 births for every 1,000 people, the government is allowing two parents from an only child background to have two children of their own. Gail Summerfield, Director of Women and Gender in Global Perspective Studies at the University of Illinois, says the policy may have succeeded in changing people's ideas about family planning.
In the countryside, most people still want at least two children, especially they want one boy to carry on the family name. But there is a sense, I think, of not wanting as many children as they had in the past.
But Grand Valley State University sociology professor Dr. Yang Yu says the bigger impact of the one-child policy is on the generations who came of age as only children.
Some only child, they are not independent at all. They don't know how to live on their own. And so they say that when they are at college and when parents are not there and they feel they are very nervous and they cannot concentrate on their studies, and that's why they call their parents, say, can you come? I need your help.
And she says there's a lot of pressure on these children to succeed.
You have only one child, and that means all your hope is on this one child, regardless of the sex of that child. And so they would like to spend as much money as they can, and they save money, and they don't spend money on themselves.
Fudan University student Chen Pei, a product of the one-child policy, says her father made it clear she was getting everything he could offer her.
My father said, I like boys, but now I have no other choice. I have to raise you. I have to try my best to raise you up.
And Beijing middle school teacher Zhang Yibing says over the past few years, she's seen a sense of selfishness develop among only children in her classroom. She says that growing up without siblings teaches children to care for themselves and not others. Because of this attitude, Zhang Yibing and her husband Lang Lang have made the decision to forego having children.
We don't want our child to be in that kind of mood, that full of selfish children. And if this is the case, we can do nothing about it.
Student Chen Pei says she doesn't plan to have any children either, but for a different reason.
If I have babies, it will cost me so much time and may kind of make you feel pressure. You'll just feel uncomfortable with the choice between work and family.
With Chinese women, just like Pei, not wanting to marry and have children, there could be an even bigger shortage of wives in a country already suffering from a gender imbalance. Director of Women and Gender and Global Perspective Studies at the U of I, Gail Summerfield, says a gender imbalance was created by parents who gave up their firstborn girl so that they could have a boy.
The stats say something like about 120 boys born for every 100 girls, which you would expect it to be more like 105 or 6. In fact, it's very likely that it might be even higher, like 130 or 135. And those stats are coming from the idea that some births are not reported.
For those women who do plan to marry and have children, Grand Valley State University sociology professor Dr. Yang Yu says the one-child policy has placed the responsibility of being a good mother under a spotlight, and expectations are often taken to extremes.
The policy didn't really liberate women from the home, and actually this policy privatized women. They want to make sure nothing bad happens to their only child, and they expect mothers to take care of that only child. And they spend more time with the only child, and they do more housework.
Chen Pei says that although her mother was still able to work, having a child to care for got in the way of her success.
My mother always complained how much time I occupied her, because she's a very successful engineer, and she always said she could be a very successful inventor if she do not have to raise their children.
It's tradition in China for children to care for their parents as they age. Sons are expected to have their parents and grandparents live with them, while daughters usually help provide for their in-laws. But young women like Pei, who are preparing to face the real world, question whether they'll continue that Chinese tradition. But she says her parents aren't putting any pressure on her to care for them later in life.
They said, we cannot rely on our only child because the child herself will be very busy at the time. You cannot rely on them, so we have to help ourselves.
U of I Director of Women and Gender and Global Perspective Studies Gail Summerfield says these days an only son or daughter taking on the responsibility for aging parents could be burdened with caring for 4 to 6 elders at one time.
And the one-child policy used to include more general health care too, but they don't anymore. I think that would be a huge effect for the elderly and the burden of taking care of the elderly, because you have to pay out of pocket to get them care much more than you did before.
Dr. Yang Yu says even those children who are willing and able to support their parents in old age might break with tradition and help their parents long distance.
The younger generation, they are more westernized, and they feel like we can financially support you, but you should have your own place, and we shouldn't live together.
That means nursing homes are becoming more common in China, especially in cities like Shanghai and Beijing. Song Ho is a 70-year-old woman in poor health. She had her three sons before population control was in place, but doesn't live with any of her children. She lives here in a care home in Shanghai.
I choose to be here because my children are very busy with their job, so they don't have enough time to look after me.
One of Song Ho's sons lives and works in Chicago. The other two live in China. She shares a small room with two other women in their 80s. One of those women, Shuang Shai Li, also has more than one child.
My children, and some of them are retired and out of job. Some of them is laid off, you know, and some of them chose to be doing business of their own, so they don't have time to look after me.
Dr. Yu says children putting parents in a nursing home is a reflection of the modernization of China.
I call it a more self-fulfillment value, more westernized value, like focusing on themselves, is we see this new value emerging in China now because of this global capitalism.
Women in China who are benefiting from that global capitalism could be experiencing feelings of liberation or even privatization. And it's not clear exactly how the Chinese family might evolve now that women have more choices to make. In Shanghai, I'm Elizabeth Murray.
While Chinese women may have more opportunity to chart their own path, not everyone agrees on how far the government is willing to go when it comes to granting more freedom. As Maria Zamudio reports, many of the students she talked to attending the most prestigious universities in China seem quite satisfied with the freedom they have.
China's economic growth is creating new opportunities for the Chinese. Many students from top universities spend much of their leisure time studying. Higher scores mean better opportunities in finding a good job. And these days, university students are much freer to choose, both in their careers and personal lives. Tsinghua University philosophy professor Daniel Bell says China is not a totalitarian society anymore. He says the government does not make an effort to control people's everyday life, and notes that the power structure has changed.
Isn't there few sources of power than they used to be, for better or worse? Because arguably, you know, it's harder for some especially disadvantaged sectors of the population now to have a decent way of life than it used to be. I mean, they have to work harder and they have less access to health care and so on. So the government does less than it used to, which is better in the sense that there's more personal freedom, especially for people in urban areas and people who are benefiting from economic reform. But it's probably harder for those who are left out of the economic boom, so to speak.
Because they no longer have to worry about government interference in their lives, many university students are not interested in politics. Student Athena Xiling attends Tsinghua University, one of the top universities in China.
There isn't much opportunity for me to think about the politics, and I'm not interested in that either.
She says she has other worries now.
I'm a little worried about my future. Because after I'm graduated, I'm 27 years old. And since then, I will consider about my job. I think I'm a little old then. I see I'm not interested in politics doesn't mean I'm not care about it. I mean, I often won't think about it. If I have opportunity to listen to some news, I will concern about them.
After talking to several students at both Peking and Tsinghua universities, it seems that most of them are very optimistic about the political future of the country. They say the economic growth is gradually leading towards more freedom. But for Yang Xinguang, it's a different story. He says he still feels the authoritarian government involved in his life. Xinguang's situation is different from other Chinese citizens. Nearly 18 years ago, he participated in the pro-democracy student movement that ended in a confrontation between the students and the military. Xinguang notes that
it's a natural expression of Chinese people to pursuing freedom after a long time of repression.
Xinguang was 20 years old at the time. The protest became stronger after the Central Communist Party published an editorial calling the students' movement illegal. The students responded with more demonstrations and a 5-day hunger strike. The student movement ended the night of June 3rd when the military invaded Tiananmen Square and opened fire on the students.
There was some order from the government warning people not to go into the streets to protect safety. That's when I knew it was a signal that the army would clear the Tiananmen Square by force.
The next day, Ching Wan's name was on the list of students accused of attempting to overthrow the government. He was arrested in July and sentenced to 2 years in prison.
The night before I was released in 1991, I had a dream. In that dream, someone told me, "Your birthday is coming, your birthday is coming, your birthday is August 30th. I said, "No, my birthday is June 4th. So you can see how this changed my life. I think my life really got started after June 4th.
Political scholar Cheng Yomiao says that while there are different versions of what happened that night, the impact was clear.
I think the student movement was a turning point in the political structure. After 1989, the Chinese government turned out to be more conservative. Comparing with the 1980s, they tended to be better and liberal. But after 1989, everyone found the enemies. Therefore, everything, including press, every decision was more conservative, except for economics. The economic activity had been loosened. In the political field, it was tightened and totalitarian. After the protest, there are more regulations for journalists.
The student protest in Tiananmen Square was also a life-changing experience for Li Xingying, who worked for the government in 1989. He was part of a team devising the new plan for economic revolution. After he heard what the government did to the students, he quit his job.
The Tiananmen event is a very important event in the pursuit of freedom in Chinese people. It is a very important event. Through this incident, I know that the Communist Party has problems with its legitimacy. And thirdly, I know that there are many limitations of ourselves, not only in government.
UIUC graduate Yu Tengwang was the general secretary for the Beijing Higher Education Student Autonomous Union. He was in jail twice for his political activities. After serving his prison terms, he left for the United States, where he's lived in exile since 2004. He finished his master's degree in physics here at UIUC and is now doing research in Virginia. Xingying now dedicates his life to human rights, and he says freedom to practice religion is one of the positive changes he sees in China.
If there were not Tiananmen Square demonstration, I might be a scientist and a professor, and I went abroad earlier, I guess. But after the Tiananmen demonstration, I made a decision to continue the course of promote democracy in China.
Wang says he's still trying to push for more democracy in China.
I was sentenced into prison. I think it's also given me more emphasis. And that's the reasons for me to continue to try to get in touch with many people in China in order to promote democracy in China. So that's the reason I try to found an opposition party, the China Democratic Party.
Tsinghua University Professor Bell says students who go abroad to study are more critical of Western democracy. He warns that it is dangerous to judge China's economic growth and potential political structure based on the Western perspective. Professor Bell says that Western-style democracy might not be the answer for China's problems.
But the question is whether at the national levels there will be a Western-style democracy, and that's where I think we need to allow for alternatives, including the possibility of more meritocratic forms of government. I mean, it's not as if democracies in all Western countries are working perfectly well, and other countries just blindly follow them. And also, if China adopts a model that owes more to its own history, it should be more stable, because people have more faith in it, perhaps, and if things go bad, they might be more likely to stick with the system if they view it as their own, not just a foreign imposition. Look at what's happening in Russia now, you know, it's moving more and more from Western-style democracy back to a kind of, strong-arm rule.
The economic growth has brought many changes in the political structure of the country, but it has also brought new problems with it. There's a growing number of people who have been left out of the economic boom. The gap between the rich and the poor is growing. GDP per capita is 2,000 yuan per year. The majority of the population is still poor. China still needs to deal with many problems. Professor Bell says that democracy might or might not be the answer to China's problems. In Beijing, I am Marina Samudio.
While the government is no longer totalitarian, that doesn't mean the Chinese are able to do anything they want. The government still exerts some control over daily life. The internet is now widely available in most urban settings, but the government also places restriction on internet use, blocking access to some websites. As Christine Wan reports, some of the most active internet users are now being labeled internet addicted.
Have you ever heard of a city where the internet bar is so excellent, wonderful, and you do not want to leave?
Addict is an ugly word to Wang Yuhe, a college student in Shanghai. She likes to say she's simply absorbed by the Asian dramas she watches on the internet.
One day, I watched a Japanese series called 交响情人梦, and there is a handsome boy. I thought I could control myself before 12 o'clock to go to bed, but when the 12 o'clock came, I think just a little more, just one more episode till I finished it. I looked up, wow, it's so bright. Suddenly I feel so sleepy. So I went to my bed and sleep all day.
Wang is one of nearly 140 million internet users in China, according to its Internet Network Information Center. Peking University communications professor Xie Xianzhou says two factors contribute to the rise of the internet: government support and economic interest.
Without big support from the government, we cannot believe that internet in China is as prosperous and as developed.
The popularity of internet in China is seen as both a blessing and a curse by many of the country's experts. Professor Guo Li Mei of Fudan University in Shanghai says one of the benefits of internet is the increased transparency of the government.
All of those citizens can use the internet to ask for help and give their opinions, make a voice. That's really very important. We even have some e-forum for the citizens, and sometimes the e-forum between the citizens and their mayor. So the city mayor should sometimes use the internet to answer the questions made by their citizens.
But another Fudan University professor, Zhou Dunzhen, explains the commonly quoted saying in China, every coin has two sides.
Protection of innocent users is not adequate. For example, the teenagers, even younger people, they might get on the internet and see the porn, and other people might sell drugs or some weapons from the internet. So these are, of course, the negative things.
And there is growing concern about what China labels as internet addiction. Skeptics call it just another way for government to control its youth. Wang's night-long Japanese drama marathon is considered by Chinese experts as a classic example of internet addiction.
The whole week I feel so uncomfortable. I cannot focus on what teachers said. I cannot concentrate myself on the study.
Tao Zhen heads an internet addiction treatment center in Daxing, a suburb of Beijing. He says five criteria are necessary to diagnose internet addicts: psychological dependence, tolerance level, withdrawal, physical symptoms, and consequences.
As long as the patients rely on the internet, it can definitely be called a mental problem.
In extreme cases, Tao says there are even physical signs such as bad eyes, malnutrition, and irregular sleep pattern.
For normal people, if something urgent comes up and they can't go on the internet, they're okay. But for addicts, they feel very uneasy and nervous. In extreme cases, their hands shake.
He says there are students who wear diapers while playing online video games, so they don't waste time going to the bathroom. Wang takes bathroom breaks, but she knows she still spends too much time on the net.
When I'm in class, I'm always sleepy. That is not very good, because when the final exam came near, I'm becoming more and more nervous, and that does a lot of harm to my health.
She, like many other internet users, does not believe she's addicted.
No, I don't think I have a disease. I don't think I have a problem.
Head psychologist of the consulting center at Tsinghua University in Beijing, Yan Li, says it's important to look at how a youngster's internet use affects the student's academics and family relationships.
They cannot find a real sense of achievement in academics. They cannot work or study. They do not know how to manage their time, so they just devote it to the internet.
A graduate student at Tsinghua, Zhang Zhishen, wrote her term paper for a social psychology class on internet addiction.
The personality of addicts is very different from ordinary people. For example, they are not self-confident, but on the internet, they can obtain respect. Also, addicts are more emotional and cannot control their emotions. They can't get along with people in real life, so that's why they turn to the internet. It offers them a way to show their true emotion.
A first-year student at Fudan University, Fang Chofui, is an internet user who fits the personality profile Zhang describes.
I'm not a sociable person, so I'm afraid to express myself. But through the internet, my classmates can know more about me. It's the only way for me to talk with others.
However, Feng says he does not spend too much time on the internet because he considers it a waste of time, and he would rather study. Han Wen, on the other hand, admits internet took over his life starting July 2006. He is one of Tao's patients at the treatment center.
I just played online games at internet bars all day and all night.
Han, a shy, soft-spoken 17-year-old of few words, says he used to play basketball to stay in shape. That was before online games began to consume all his time.
My parents asked me to come here to improve my health and to receive psychological counseling. In the beginning, I didn't like coming here, but gradually, I agreed with my parents. I played online games at cost of everything. I just paid no attention to time. I devoted everything to the internet.
At the clinic, psychological and physical treatments are available. Han's daily schedule includes an early morning run, meetings with doctors, and group activities such as basketball. He says basketball is his new addiction.
I especially love playing basketball. I played many matches and won many championships just because of love. I did all these things.
Han is scheduled to be released from the clinic after finishing 2 months of treatment. Tao says 70% of internet addicts will be cured after 1 to 3 months at the clinic, as long as it doesn't develop into a more serious problem like depression.
Good habits will lead to good fortune and good destination. Bad habits will lead to bad life. At the clinic, we have military training that practices lots of good habits. We encourage our patients to develop good regular habits to replace their bad ones. It's a behavior therapy treatment.
After his release, Han will be tracked for about 6 months by the center's assistants through phone calls, emails, or letters to parents. Han says he plans to study hard when he returns to school. Tao says about 20% of graduates of the treatment center will become re-addicted to the internet. In Beijing, I'm Christine Wan.
This concludes China, Beyond the Great Wall, a 2-hour special produced by journalism students at the University of Illinois.
We fought and overcame a language barrier. We adapted our methods to a different culture, and our trip brought us in touch with the gracious people who are becoming an increasingly important part of the global community.
With 60% of the world's construction cranes in China and the migration of 100 million people within the country, we saw evidence of economic growth on a scale beyond what any of us imagined. China is predicted to overtake the U.S. economy by 2025, and Illinois plays an important role in that economic growth, with its fifth place ranking among U.S. states that export to China.
But even as China's economy grows at close to 11% a year, over 90 million Chinese still make well below $1 a day. Thanks for joining us. I'm Lauren Thorbjornsen.
And I'm Sam Unger.
We would like to thank those who made this program possible. China Beyond the Great Wall was underwritten by University of Illinois Chancellor Richard Herman, the Center for Global Studies, the Center for International Business Education and Research, and Leon Dash of the Center for Advanced Study. We would also like to give thanks to University of Illinois alumni and former visiting scholars in China who offered their help and support during our visit to China. We hope you've enjoyed listening to China Beyond the Great Wall.
谁在讲着，谁在一头无力的自责。